argument, United States v. Mendoza. Ms. Gambino.
Good afternoon, Judge Posner, Judge Kaney, and Judge Rovner. There were three issues on appeal for Mr. Mendoza: sufficiency of the evidence, the fact that the district court did not follow the federal rules of criminal procedure in determining who would be alternate jurors.
Yeah, but that's harmless, right?
No, Your Honor. In this case, our position is that it's not harmless.
Right.
It's not harmless because what ended up happening in this case is that the jurors were selected, and one of the jurors that was dismissed was the only Hispanic juror.
No, that's just an accident. No. It's harmless in the sense that this way of picking the alternates seems perfectly sensible, but in any event, does seem to violate Rule 28. But it's not harmful to defendants or favorable to prosecutors, right? Okay. It may be in a particular case you'd do better under the Rule 28, and in another case you'd do better under this random shuffle.
Well, Your Honor, no, I disagree with that. And the harm is that when you go to select a jury and you plan your argument, you plan your approach, you plan a lot of what you do based on who your jurors are going to be. It's very important to know precisely who it is you're going to be arguing to and precisely how you're going to employ your challenges. And particularly in a case like this, and we have to consider the actual fact that occurred. There's a reason for the federal rules, and even this court has said that the federal rules are assumed to produce a fair and reasonable approach to jury selection. Other circuits have found that this is the consensus of the bar and the bench, and that it's not to be taken lightly. Defendants and prosecutors have to follow the rules. The courts should also have to follow the rules. And when you have an occasion like this, where there is a single person of the same origin as the defendant, and the defendant was counting on trying the case to this juror because this was a juror that was selected during the initial two panels.
Yeah, but you knew in advance what Judge Sharp's policy was with regard to selection, right?
That's correct. He did announce that policy.
Now, of course, our case law finds unconstitutional those strikes that are based on the race or ethnicity of a juror, so wouldn't it be inconsistent to then hold that you're constitutionally entitled to a particular juror based on that juror's particular ethnicity?
Well, it's not the question that you're entitled to that particular juror, but in the ordinary course, in the system designed by the rules and agreed by the rules, you know that you've consciously selected that person, and that person has actually been...
You're pitching your argument to his presumed biases?
Excuse me?
And you're pitching your argument to his presumed ethnic bias?
No, I'm not pinching my argument to his presumed ethnic bias, but you count on a particular composition of the jury, and if, for instance, the government had struck that juror who was the only Hispanic juror, there's a process under Batson for challenging that strike. When this is something that happens because of a random selection, there's no opportunity to challenge.
But that's true with the jurors you get to examine in the first place, right? I mean, you have 40 jurors come into a courtroom, and you only get a few of them. You may be some in the audience you'd prefer to have rather than the ones that ended up being in the jury box, right?
That's correct. But the problem is you've set up a procedure under the federal rules by which the jurors and the alternates are supposed to be selected separately. And when you basically say we're going to deny that for no particular reason, and no stated reason other than this is just the way that this particular judge wants to do it, then you end up introducing a factor of randomness in there that's not intended by the rules, and that in this particular case served the unfortunate purpose of depriving Mr. Mendoza of having the only Hispanic juror selected on the jury.
That happens as what I described. The Jovinari comes in, and you don't know whether the Hispanics who were in the Venari are going to make it to the actual petit jury, right?
That's correct. But once you have a strike selection process, and the Hispanic juror that you've consciously chosen, that you've not exercised a peremptory against, and nor has the government. Once you have that person seated as part of the initial pool, then you expect under and would be entitled under the rules to have that person sit and hear your case.
There was no objection, was there?
There was not at the time of the trial. There was an objection raised
in post-trial motions. So in other words, it's heads you win, tails the government loses. You either get an acquittal or you get a new trial.
Well, no, that's not true. This issue was raised in post-trial motions, and
that's too late. That's after the trial. He might have been acquitted, right? That would be the end of it.
He might have been.
The lawyer might have preferred this system. They like this system.
But the point is that the system is set up under the rules for a particular purpose. And in this particular situation, the rules were violated, and Mr. Mendoza was deprived of a jury that included a Hispanic member it otherwise would have had.
What is the indication that the jury was not impartial, though? Is there any such indication?
Well,
isn't that what we need to look at?
It's impossible to tell from the record that the jury was impartial. It was not impartial other than the fact that they, of course, convicted Mr. Mendoza, and we don't know what the effect would have been had this other gentleman been included in the jury as he should have been.
Would your argument be different if the alternate hadn't been minority?
It wouldn't have been quite the same, but it would have been no less strong, because it still goes to...
Well, it would be no less strong, you're saying, that the fact that there was a Hispanic doesn't add anything, right?
It does add something to
this. No, it can't. If your argument would be just as strong without the Hispanic, then the Hispanic's presence cannot add anything to your argument. That's a matter of simple logic. You're saying they're equally strong either way, with or without the Hispanic. If they're equally strong either way, adding Hispanic doesn't change anything.
Well, let me be more precise. It is stronger with the Hispanic, but it does not destroy the argument if the Hispanic was not there. The harm is, in particular, more egregious in this case because of that. The second issue that I wanted to address was with respect to sentencing, because there seems to be a split in this circuit with respect to whether the presumption, the rebuttable presumption applies at the district court level. This court seemed...
No, I think we've been clear. There's no presumption at the district court level. And that was a mistake by Judge Sharp. Mm-hmm. But if you read his sentencing transcript in its entirety, he went through everything. And he discussed 3553A. Yeah. So we've had several cases recently where the transcript contains a mistake. I mean, I understand how the judges are confused by this business in the wake of Booker. But as I say, he seemed to go through everything, didn't
he? The problem is the weight that he gave.
To put it this way, if we sent it back and said, you know, Judge, you're going to have to resentence this guy because he said presumption, isn't it perfectly clear he'd give him the same sentence?
No, Your Honor, it's not. I think he believed that he had to give a guideline sentence unless the strength of...
If he thought that, why did he discuss all these other... Why did he discuss all these other aspects?
He discussed them, and he clearly stated that it was the burden of the defendant under this rebuttable presumption to show that his sentence was unreasonable.
That is not the tenor of his opinion. That is not the tenor of his opinion. That's something he said at the beginning.
And he repeated that. He repeated that not only was it a presumption, a rebuttable presumption, and that there was a presumption of correctness, but that it was the defendant's burden to show that there were factors that made his sentence unreasonable.
I don't understand. You say, I'm looking at A21. Court has considered the guidelines, the record as a whole. Court has weighed the defendant's age, criminal history, risk of recidivism, need to protect society, along with the issues raised by the defendant's sentencing memorandum, and so on and so on. Recognizing the discretion afforded to this court by Booker and his progeny, this court declines to impose a non-guideline sentence. So what's wrong with that?
And he finishes by saying, I believe that what I'm doing is both authorized and indeed made mandatory by the relevant law in the circuit. I get no pleasure in this. I believe that he thought
sure,
he was bound
the
by the guidelines.
The relevant law is 3553A. Right? And he's gone through all those things.
I think the starting point is important. When he believes that there's greater weight to be given to the guidelines than there is to the other factors, which is clearly not the law under the circuit's opinion in Demaret, and it's not the law under the Supreme Court's opinion, that he started at the wrong place. That he gave more weight to the guidelines than he should have, and his decision might possibly have been different to the benefit of Mr. Mendoza. I see my time is up, Your Honor. I ask that the court remand for resentencing.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gambino. Mr. Holler?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I guess I'll start first with the jury selection issue, and I would really just echo most of the comments of the court. This is a plain error standard. The defendant, unlike the defendant in Patterson and in many of the cases that we cited in our brief, did not even raise this issue at trial, and there's really no colorable argument that there was any confusion as to what the procedures were. And I do agree with you, Judge.
How widespread is this jury selection pattern in the Northern District of Indiana?
Judge Sharp's the only judge who does the jury selection this way. And
but he does this
every criminal trial.
Yes, no one has ever objected.
Well, on this record, I don't know this. From my discussions with the South Bend office in the 2 months since this has come up, there was some recollection that maybe 15 years ago somebody had objected, and rather than brief the issue, he had done it a different way in that trial or something. But
so this is the way he does it, but if someone objected, presumably.
That's anecdotal that one time.
Not in the record. We're all curious.
Somebody had done that. Judge Kaney, you may know better than I. And
I did not realize that this is his jury selection method, but we're in different divisions, so that's why.
Well, the longest serving assistant U.S. attorney in that district started in 1983, which was 10 years after Judge Sharp joined the bench, and he has informed me that he did do it then. And it was his recollection. I thought I had a trial once, and somebody objected, and rather than brief the issue, we just did it the way Judge Miller does it, and mm-hmm. that was for one trial. In any event, I think Your Honors are on point. It's another procedure. It appears to have come up, frankly, somewhat frequently throughout the country that other people came up with this procedure. So it's not something that he came up with on his own, although it is not anything any of the other judges in the Northern District follow. They all have. But there's a lot of variety in jury selection methods. It's not as if the other six judges.
Apparently, it's also been found to be error by the other circuits who considered it.
Well, yes,
we're not
conceding right, that. We're not defending
right,
the procedure.
Doesn't square with the rule.
But, it's something that comes up in housekeeping procedures, and everybody has different. It's not as if Rule 24 says the procedure of random jury selections is improper. You have to kind of read through the rules, and when you do the analysis, yes, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. We're not denying that. But it's not something that someone's going to go in front of a district judge and say, Judge, I think we should parse through this rule a little bit while we're talking about your procedures. And I don't know. I just don't think that's a good way to start out the first day of a trial normally. The only other thing that I would point out, though, is the defendant does seem to be making some kind of implication that she had some right to a specific juror to sit there. And the only thing I would point out is, as you pointed out, Judge Kaney, if this particular juror, the ideal juror, regardless of race, had been in the back of the courtroom and never made it to the selection panel, it wouldn't have mattered. And even more so, if you want to argue about pitching the argument, this juror could have been sitting in seat number one the entire trial for openings, trial, closing arguments. The jury could have gone out to lunch, and he could have gotten a phone call that said, your wife's in the hospital, you can't serve anymore. And he could have been replaced with an alternate then. Well, you pitch the argument, and all of a sudden, this just happens in trial. And I think the fact that it probably hasn't come up in 33 years is more a testament to the fact that it rarely matters than to the fact that some error that requires reversal by this court occurred. I will rest on my brief on sufficiency of the evidence, as the defendant did. On sentencing, I really think that Judge Sharp made one error on page 26 of the transcript when he referred to a rebuttable presumption, but I think at the district court level. The fact that in his sentencing memorandum he refers to the fact that there is a presumption on appeal is just sort of the state of the law. Judge Sharp often makes comments about his views of the state of the law, but he does, when directed by this court or when directed by the Supreme Court, faithfully apply that law. And I just don't see anything objectionable to his statement that, you know, in my courtroom, generally but not always, I follow the guidelines. Generally, I give the minimum of the guideline range. I think under the 3553A factors, that's what you're supposed to do. He knows he doesn't always have to give the guidelines. I've been up here, and other individuals from my court, from my office have been up here appealing sentences we feel are too low, and on cases where the defendant has appealed for other reasons where he's given below-guideline sentences. It's just not the case that he, whatever he thinks, he went through the analysis, he looked at the factors, and really, if you look at this case, the key issue for Mr. Mendoza, frankly, is whether he gets a consecutive sentence or not, because he's going to be he's in the Indiana State Prison. He's going to be getting credit for all of that time unless the BOP changes their guidelines. And, you know, if this case was remanded and he got his sentence reduced to 60 months but was ordered to serve it consecutive to Indiana State time, he's going to have a higher sentence in practical terms. And that doesn't diminish the argument, but I just think under the precedent of this court, I don't think that anything here is unreasonable, and I don't think any error of law is so sufficient as to justify reversal. And if the court has no further questions, I would rest on my brief, as I said, on sufficiency and ask that this court affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holland. Mr. Gambino, do you have anything further? I'll give you a minute.
First of all, it is worth pointing out that every other circuit that has addressed the jury selection issue has found it error.
We all know that.
And
we all agree. Mr. Holler agrees.
In those districts in which it has been used for a reason. There were at least two other cases in which they used this random selection to protect witnesses or to protect the jurors because there had been threats of violence. There was no reason similar to that to use this procedure in this particular case. And with respect to the sentencing, the judge very clearly, both written in his written and oral opinion.
Are you saying the rule can be waived if there's a threat?
I'm saying that it makes more sense, or there's more reason not to follow the rule
Is that permissible?
Court and other courts have, yes, there's discretion in dealing.
There is discretion?
There is discretion.
Where is that in the rule?
That's in the case law. The cases have.
So it looks as if the rule doesn't actually mean what it says.
Well, the rule.
It has a secret exception.
The purpose for discretion is to be able to exercise it when there is a reason to do so. There was no reason to do so in this case, and it inured to the prejudice of Mr. Mendoza. With respect to the sentencing, the judge very clearly looked at McTeague and Robinson, which
is Mr. Holler correct that Judge Sharp has given below-guideline sentences since Booker?
I don't know what his sentencing record is since Booker.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Ms. Gambino, I'd like to add something. Say congratulations for being the first attorney in 33 years brave enough to come in here with that argument.
Thank you.